Okay, I'm now officially on. You may not know how many years I worked in credit derivatives, and there's a link here. Lane and I actually wrote a paper with a couple of junior colleagues at Merrill Lynch in 1994 on pricing credit default swaps, or as we termed at the time, credit default options, which is really what they are. And this was years before the market itself existed, and it may even be the first published paper directly addressing credit derivatives pricing. So there is some history behind this. Talk today is a paper that should have been done about 10 years ago. It's in many ways elementary and perhaps somewhat elemental. I mean, it's really just trying to bring credit derivatives analysis a little bit back into traditional finance replication, arbitrage, or no arbitrage, perhaps, framework, as opposed to the particular path it has taken from the beginning. So I'm going to treat single name credit default swaps as fundamental building blocks. I'm not going to try and derive them from anything else. I think I'm somewhat justified in doing this on the basis of, by according to ISTA last week, there are now $34.5 trillion notional outstanding of them. This is from about 10 years ago. They far outstrip the supply of underlying bonds that they're referencing, and they're much more liquid than any corporate bonds, and I think are very well suited, as we'll see, to be the natural building blocks. They're also the way you can trade credit risk in a way that's largely, but not completely, separate from interest and other risks that come into play. So I'll take a little stray into the world of credit default swap indices, which are very important to the market in their own right, but also they provide kind of a nice little motivational example for what I'm going to do. And then given a lot of anybody who sort of picked up a paper or a textbook addressing credit modeling will find that there is this kind of push between structural fundamental models and models that are based on more reduced form, slightly higher level of abstraction. And I'm happy to say that while we will sneak in a couple of non-trivial assumptions in the analysis here, this analysis I'm showing today is equally applicable to any underlying default dynamics. So it's pretty general in that sense. Let's see. So credit default swap indices, as I said, I mean, they've really become a major element in credit markets and maybe even broader financial markets over the last 5 years. And so a very natural question, the first thing you basically ask is, well, okay, so to what extent can I price a credit default swap on an index relative to the underlying single name credit defaults that it's made up of? And sort of the other side of the same coin, under what conditions can you replicate the index by the components? And historically, that is the same question. It's just two ways of formulating the same question. And somehow, as I alluded to earlier, the credit derivatives market from day one, more or less, just separated pricing from hedging or replication. Prices somehow arose in the market, and then with prices in hand, you start saying, well, okay, we'll think about how to do some trading to reduce risk, but it wasn't formally a pricing by replication that we at least we've gone through the motion in the other areas, whether it be equity derivatives, FX derivatives, interest rate derivatives. You start with some process, then you impose a certain set of trading strategies that you can use to generate contingent claims from which you can then derive prices or perhaps limits on prices. So So, and in the beginning, I think this came from this notion that, you know, CDSs by themselves, they truly are fundamental. You really cannot replicate them. But with CDS in hand, what does the family of credit default swaps, what kind of payoffs do they really span? And that's, in particular, we're going to look at static positions in credit default swaps and see what can we replicate with them. Okay, so just let's take a trade. So you have a friendly banker who proposes a trade. It's a very simple trade. You buy protection on the 10-year iTrax crossover index. So this is an index of 50 names that are rated just on the cusp of investment grade junk status. And these numbers aren't too far away from the real world, although they might be a tad high. So you buy protection for 10 years on this index at a premium of 320 basis points running. And not to leave you with a bunch of risk here, I'll do a back-to-back transaction where I'll sell you back protection on the corresponding basket of 50 single names, the exact basket that makes up the index, for premium of 330 basis points running. So you have a perfect hedge. Well, there's some small print on the default legs. You're perfectly hedged on the default legs. And you're collecting a net 10 basis point premium running. This is a good trade. You want to do this in size, right? Kind of order for $1 billion. Which would be good. And I don't actually work for a bank at the moment, but I've been hanging out with a lot of friendly bankers, and there's usually a reason why these kind of trades arise. And as you may have suspected, there is something wrong here, or at least something a little bit worth thinking about. And I think it's at least sort of in inside circles, it's pretty well known, but I don't think so well understood that there, even in the theoretical pure world, there still ought to be some kind of basis or difference between the average of the single name CDS premiums and the corresponding index premium. Now, there are, in the U.S., there is a specific reason, or the North American index, I should say, there's a specific reason because the index trades with a slightly different set of default events than the corresponding liquid underlying single name contracts. The question is whether restructuring is a credit event or not. In Europe, there's not one of that mismatch, which is kind of why I picked the iTrax to begin with as an example. So well, what's going on here? So we'll try and get a little deeper into this. So what is a credit index anyway? So just starting with single name building block, the little j just indexes the, or references a particular name. And the idea when you enter into a single name credit default swap is you pay some premium, and that's what's quoted. And the swap has two legs. On one hand, you got the premium leg. So to find the present value of that, you take the premium rate you're paying and you multiply it by some risky annuity. So this is exactly like a good old-fashioned sort of, it used to be that there was a field called financial mathematics, and it was about calculating the value of annuities from a set of interest rates. Now, this is just like that, except it's risky. So if the company, if the name that is referenced defaults, the annuity will stop. No recovery, no nothing, it just stops. That is the way the premium leg on a CDS contract works. And this premium level has been set by the market in such a way that the premium leg equals in value to the default leg. I'm not going to say how the default leg value is estimated, or for that matter, how the risk annuity is estimated, but just as a matter of balance, this is the equation between the two legs. Now, what about the index? Well, the index is just about the same equation, except there's one single premium you're paying on the index, and you're paying this on the notional that's remaining at any point in time. So you just add up the risky annuities for each of the underlying names, and you get the premium leg for the index. And then the default leg is simply just the sum of all the default legs. So just rearranging this slightly and using a very small amount of algebra, we get that the index spread should theoretically here be the weighted average of the single name spreads, where the weight is proportional to the value of the risk annuity for each name. So if you're going to say anything intelligent about sort of generalizing these single name CDS prices and looking at the portfolio, we need to be able to say something about the risk annuity value. So if we think about this particular transaction we're talking about, you can break it into 50 pairs of single name swaps, where one swap is on market, that's sort of your hedge, and the other is off market. Why is it off market? Well, because the single name CDS that comes out of the index all have the same premium level. So, and only by pure chance would that happen to be the correct premium level for that name, and in general it will be somewhere high or low. So if you consider each of these pairs, then you'll have the default legs will match, you can put them away, and then there will be a leftover piece. It's the net risky annuity that you'll be receiving or paying, but this is not randomized. You'll basically be receiving net premium flows until defaults on the high spread names, and you'll be paying net premiums on the low spread names. And now you may start thinking, well, gee, is this going to last forever? And of course it could. I mean, it could be that there's no defaults at all in the period you're looking at, and then everybody is happy, and you will have collected your 10 basis points for the whole period. But if you start seeing defaults, you're much more likely to seeing defaults for the high spread names. So this positive carry you're having is going to flip, or may flip, and turn negative. And in particular, if you're in a high-stress environment, you may find that it can be very negative, even though your default legs are perfectly hedged. So it's all about the risk annuities and the premium legs. So the question is, well, can we price risk annuities? And somewhat more generally, can we price sort of arbitrary claims on the default time, of which this is a particular example? So I'm gonna rush through a little bit of this, but the story, we're trying to draw some analogies here to the early work by Bryden and Litzenberger and Steve Ross, who showed, this is not so far into the 70s, that you take a static position in European options, and if you can take positions across all strikes and for certain purposes maturities, you can replicate all non-path dependent options that way. And you can replicate them statically at a known cost up front, which means you can price them. And you have nice results that the second derivative of a European either put or call price with respect to the strike, you can interpret as a state price density, or rescale it by the discount factor and get a risk neutral density for the stock price at that date. So we're going to try and do something similar. Another perspective on what they were doing is that you can relate this state price density. You can view it as the Green's function for a particular linear operator, characterized by a second order PDE in the simplest cases. And we'll show that somewhat similarly, taking positions in a continuum of CDS across maturities for a single name, we can replicate all the claims on default times. And we can also, and I'll do a little bit of that here, relate the replication to the Green's function for a particular linear operator, in this case a second order ODE. So there are some similarities here to sort of classic West Coast finance. So what are we going to do? Well, if you think about pricing a European option, in some sense it's all about, and sort of on a stock, it's all about what is the stock price going to be at the maturity date. So now there is some interest rate risk to be concerned with, but it's at least over a well-defined finite period. Now on the CDS, you're going to have, the question is, well, is there a default or not? If there is a default, when does it happen? And if there is a default, furthermore, what is the recovery or equivalently, what is the loss given default? So to sort of make the problem solvable and at least simple, we'll assume away two of the problems here. We'll assume deterministic interest rates, just following the forwards, and we'll assume deterministic recoveries in default. Now, those are the real, this is where the rabbit goes into the hat in some sense. Then we make a couple of simplifying assumptions. So we're basically assuming continuity and to some extent differentiability where we need it just to use calculus. I've actually worked out a discrete version that dispenses with most of those, and it's not changing the fundamentals of what we're doing here. But then it's worth iterating at least briefly that we're going to make no assumptions on the default generating process. And we're also, I guess I'll get to that. So let me tell you what exactly we're trying to do. We're going to pick a name, any name. But it, for the purposes that goes on, it better be a name with some credit default swaps traded on it. And tau I'm going to use to denote its default time. So it's a random variable strictly greater than the current time, which I'll call zero. And I'm going to consider a target which you may think of as a bond, or it's not quite a bond, actually. But it's something closely related to a bond. So it's going to pay a continuous coupon, CTDT, up until the earlier of its maturity date or default of the underlying name. And if there is a default, it'll pay some known function of the default date. So if the default date is before its maturity or otherwise, it'll pay zero. And I'm going to make the assumption here that both C and R are differentiable functions of time. And I want to replicate this the payoffs of this claim by static positions in standard par CDS entered into at time zero, and then I'm going to use a position in a money market account to move money across time. So the only dynamics going on here is self-financing flows in and out of the money market account just to pay premium, or actually as it may be, receive premium, pay out the coupon on the instrument I'm replicating. I get some interest from money in the money market account, and then if there is a default, we settle up and walk away. The idea is that this is all, we set it up and then it's all self-financing and netting to zero. So a little bit of notation and what's going in here. So with a fixed recovery, this without any loss of or really anything here, I can make the recovery a deterministic function of time. Although it actually changes the derivation a little bit, but the results all flow through. But to mimic what's pretty much being done in the market, these assumptions, by the way, is exactly what people use day-to-day in the CDS market, and certainly in the more complex structured credit derivative market. People invariably, unless there's something most peculiar about the name, you assume a 40% recovery, which in this case would correspond to 60% of notional will be paid out upon default to the CDS. So that's my capital L. And interest rates are assumed to be deterministic and just given by the forward rates. And I'll denote those with little r. And the current par CDS rate, so the assumption here is I'm going to assume that there is a CDS rate quoted for any maturity up to some finite point in time. Well, there is a high degree of realism to this in the sense that you can call up Lehman Brothers or JP Morgan or some such outfit and ask for a credit default swap maturing on December 6th, 2013. The trader will say, well, how about December 20th? That's a standard maturity date. It's much better. And you said, no, I mean December 6th. And it said, fine, but it's going to cost you a basis point or two or whatever. Now, if you called up the same banker and said, I would like quotes for every day for the next 10 years, a certain amount of grumpiness would, if you're PIMCO, I'm sure you would get it. But by and large, this it stretches things a little bit. But anyway, I will assume you can do this. And in particular, I would assume that the corresponding premium schedule is well-defined and that it and the interest rates are differentiable as functions of time. I think these are actually, I view these as fairly innocuous assumptions. In particular, and we'll touch on this perhaps at the very end, but since you will know here a priori which side of the market you will be on. So I'm not assuming zero bid offer spread here. I mean, you can put this on the side of the market you have to, and this will be fully reflected in the cost of your hedge. So as I said, I mean, this is in some sense fairly characteristic of the state of analysis done in practice at this very moment. Hold on, doesn't mean it's right. And I don't need future CDS contracts or rates or markets, and this is a completely static story as far as trading here is concerned. So how am I going to do this? I've used a lot of words to describe this, but this is actually a well-specified problem here. So how am I going to try and solve it? Well, I haven't written it yet, but so here is what we have to work with. For each point in time between now and maturity, and I don't really want to spend time convincing you that we don't need to do stuff past maturity. So for each point in time, there are really two quantities I have to work with. It's the amount of money I'm going to have sitting in my money market account on time T. I'm going to call that M, which is conditional on the underlying name not having defaulted yet. That's one control. And the other one, I mean, this is like it's a control, although I'm going to control it somewhat indirectly. It will result from what I put into the money market account initially, and then the flows over time until time little t. And then my other control is the number of CDS contracts I write for maturity t, or the rate at which I'm writing CDS contracts for maturity t. So I'm sort of thinking here, well, I have at each point in time, if I haven't defaulted yet, one out of two things can happen. I can default or I can not default. And I have two controls, so I got kind of a binomial problem. Let's see if we can solve it in a binomial fashion. So we've gone up to time little t, wherever that is, and we haven't defaulted yet. So this is ultimately a dynamic programming story. We're going to start at the end and work back to the beginning. So we need to be prepared for the possibility that this is indeed the moment of truth. We have to pay up. So it means that the amount I have at that point in my money market account needs to be able to cover two things. I will have written QUDU of the notional CDS protection for maturity U for all maturities from little t to big T. So I add those up and I multiply by the loss given default per unit of notional. At this point in time, you don't really care what the maturity is. It's on your books. You have to pay out. So that's going to bleed out of my, or not so much bleed, it's going to hemorrhage suddenly out of my money market account. And what's left over, I need to use to settle the default contingent payment on the derivative I'm hedging here. So I got this annoying integral, so I can get rid of that by differentiating with respect to little t and just rearrange. So then I can get the quantity of CDS protection for time t written explicitly in terms of capital R, which is the contractual term, L, which is a fixed assumption, and M, or rather the derivative of M with respect to time, which is one of my controls. So far this is good. I've gotten rid of one of my unknowns expressed in terms of the other, so I can move on. So what if t is not the default time? Well, this one can think of in a couple of ways, but I think the cleanest way to think about it is, well, what are the flows at this point then? So what is going to be the change in the what's in my money market account? Well, first of all, I'm earning interest at the rate of R of T. I'm earning it on the immediately preceding notional. Things are continuous here, so I don't need to worry about which file I'm coming from, but this is really the notional immediately preceding it, so I'm getting RT DT in interest times M. And then I am paying out CT DT on my claim that I'm replicating. And finally, I'm earning for each maturity U, I have QU DU in notional, and I'm written that at the original premium S, the little zero is there to denote that was the original premium at time zero for maturity U. I add it up across maturities, and that's my inflow from my protection written at that point. So again, we have an integral we want to get rid of, differentiate with respect to the lower limit here, and we get this is just the product rule here, and we get a derivative of the coupon flow. So I have another equation here characterizing my money market account balance M. And if I take that and put it together with the explicit solution for Q from the previous case, I get a nice, clean, simple, second-order, linear, inhomogeneous ODE for the money market, the default contingent, or non-default contingent, perhaps, money market account balance M. And the forcing term over here is characterized by C and R, which are the contractual terms, L, which is my assumption, and S, which is the initial CDS level. So we need the second order ODE here, so we need two terminal conditions. The first one is simply that at maturity, I can walk away from this with no money in the bank and owing nothing. And the second one is, and this really is just information that we lost when we differentiated down once. So this is just saying that the last outflow is just the coupon outflow. And because you're sitting with next to nothing in the money market account, it's not going to earn any interest, and you've squeezed down the amount of CDS notionals left, so you're not going to earn any premium. So that's the last little bit in the money market account to flow out. So we have a complete solution. We have a well-defined, well-behaved, as it happens, a terminal value problem here, which gives us the path of the survival contingent money market account. Well, okay, so what does that really give us? Well, it gives us two things. It gives us explicitly, for any particular contract here, it gives us the amount of CDS notional I need to write for each date from zero up to maturity. And then by assumption or by construct and by market practice, these CDS contracts are written at par. So the only money I need to fund this at inception is what I put into the money market account. So M of zero is the no arbitrage value for this claim. And now, in general, this needs to be solved numerically, but if you're going to solve something numerically, this is about as well behaved as it comes. So you can put this in, and depending on where you need to do it, you can throw it into Mathematica and it'll do it for you just like that. And if I had been slightly less lazy, I would have brought up some pictures that you can see what they look like, but they do behave quite well. I'll give you a closed form solution in passing as we go here. Natural closed form solutions arise if you have constant parameters. I talked a lot about risk annuities earlier. Let's get back to them and say, well, okay, so what about replicating one of these risk annuities we talked about? Setting the premium leg equal to 1 per unit of time and the payment upon default to 0 gives us a risk annuity, a unit risk annuity if you want. So, well, I can just plug that in on the previous page. I notice that the forcing term goes to 0, so I actually have the corresponding homogeneous ODE here. And it's sitting right here, and again, the boundary conditions are just special cases. Terminal value equal to 0 and the slope -1, and the time 0 value of this of the money market account is the initial value of the risky annuity, and then by again the expression for the hedging quantity or the replicating strategy simplifies a little bit also, and it's just the time derivative of the default contingent money market account scaled by the loss given default. So one thing that sort of obviously pops out of all of this is that to replicate a risky annuity, you need to take positions in all the CDS maturities from time zero to the maturity of the risky annuity, which means back to the story of index replication, if you want to replicate a 10-year CDS index with the underlying single name CDSs, you don't just need to use 10-year single name CDSs, you need to use the whole spectrum of maturities below that, which is not necessarily obvious a priori, although if you think long enough about it, I guess it becomes obvious. So that was just doing the risky annuity in the way we just did, in backward. But if what we really cared about, as turns out we may, is the value up front of risky annuities for many different maturities, well, then we might actually, I mean, so we could just do what we just described and repeat it tediously one after the other, and you'll probably find that you can do it for a few maturities and interpolate nicely in between, but it might indeed be possible to solve this in a forward manner. And so let's take a look and see if we can find an adjoint forward solution here. So now by assumption, basically I assumed enough smoothness up front that I can without working very hard assert that this ensures a density representation for the risk neutral default time distribution, at least up until for the part of it that's covered by the maturities of concern here. So I'm going to let little h denote the risk neutral default time distribution, and I'm pretty, now all of a sudden I can assert the not just existence but uniqueness of such a thing, because I already demonstrated to you that I can price default contingent claims by pure replication. So I'm not just waving hands and say, well, assume a can opener or assume a risk neutral measure. This exists and is unique. So then now let's just take a standard CDS and look at how do we write the value of its legs. So let's start with the default leg with notional of 1, maturity U, and so upon the default time, so on the right hand side here I have L, which is what's going to be paid at the default time, I have a discount factor, and I have the probability of defaulting at time S. I multiply those together and integrate up to time S running from 0 to U. So that's the value of the default leg. Now by the balance equation I put up, the very first equation I put up, I'm saying that, well, that default leg is going to be equal in value to the premium leg. Okay? So that's the left-hand side of the balance equation. This is the right-hand side, that where I substituted in an explicit representation of the value of the default leg in terms of an assumed to exist, I'm not assuming it exists. I know it exists, but I don't know what it is yet. Risk-neutral default time density. So just differentiating and rearranging, I get an explicit or fairly explicit representation for the default time density at time U. Okay, hold that for a moment, and now I'm going to take the unit premium leg, and I'm going to say, well, what is the value of the premium leg? Well, it's the risky annuity, that's by so the S over here is just 1, and so it's, I'm going to integrate up to maturity the discount factor times the probability of not having defaulted yet, so that's the survival probability. And now just to simplify out these integrals, I need to differentiate first with respect to U, rearranging, and then repeating one more time, and it's a small exercise left to the reader to show that just doing that twice will give us an alternative characterization of the default time density. Putting these two characterizations together gives me a nice, another nice second order linear ODE, this time homogeneous, for the initial value of the risk annuity for across different maturities. And boundary conditions, well, these are actually pretty intuitive. First one is a risk annuity maturing today. It's worthless. There's no time for it to do anything. And furthermore, the first promised penny is going to be subject to just vanishing both discounting and risk of default. So it's going to start out with a slope of 1, and then, of course, it's going to get pushed down by both discounting and default risk. So, but this way, in one sweep forward, you can calculate all the risk annuities. Now, why do we care about that so much? Well, I already sort of alluded to this ODE being the adjoint of the former. Indeed, it characterizes the Green's function of the former, and I'm now into one of the very many parts of mathematics I have little expertise in, but I can just happily state that, you know, if you can solve for this Green's function, which is a very slight generalization of the risk annuity we just found there, well, then solving for a whole family of derivatives values or contingent claim values is found just by straightforward integrating the Green's function against the forcing term in the original of the, so you can there's a lot of efficiency in it, and that's pretty much, it's all just sort of reformulating what I've said, putting it in proper linear operator language here. A little more in the paper, which we keep on rewriting, or keep on planning to rewrite. So just taking a quick look at closed-form solutions, one which is, I think, matches people's intuition pretty well is if the CDS curve is flat. This is a highly unlikely shape, by the way, but anyway, if it is flat, then you can just integrate this up, and what you find is that the value of a risky annuity is given simply by discounting at a yield plus a spread. The yield is the standard yield, just average over time of the instantaneous risk-free rate. And the spread is given by the implied default probability. I mean, S0 over L, or S0 over 1 minus R. Lambda would be a very typical symbol to use for it, because it has this notion of an intensity if you were to map this into a sort of hazard rate model, lambda would be the hazard rate, and indeed in this case it would be flat. So, and we can differentiate this out and actually find that the risk neutral survival probability is exactly what comes out of of the starting point of assuming, let me assume that I have a causal jump characterizing my default time, and I'm going to assume that there is some intensity characterizing this, and then I'm going to fit that intensity to my CDS spreads, and I happen to have a flat CDS curve, and I'm going to get out a flat lambda, which is given by my quoted spread dividing by my loss given default, and it's flat regardless of what the yield curve is. It's like the one case where you know that there is no interaction terms coming. But it's what is sort of interesting is that, and you can generalize this now to look at slightly different cases, but this, of course, recall this was entirely developed assuming nothing like the existence of hazard rates. I mean, this could, as I said, we were completely silent on what is the underlying default driving model here. So in many ways, I think what we're doing is we're providing a rigorous foundation for a lot of the practice that has evolved in terms of saying, well, I'm going to take these CDS rates I can observe, I can do some interpolation, perhaps some extrapolation, and then I'm going to fit some piecewise constant or splined or otherwise hazard rate to it, and then I'm going to make believe that that's actually what's happening. And it's very similar in some sense to the way we bootstrap LIBOR curves or swap curves. You say, well, assume that interest rates are deterministic, project out payments on that basis, discount them back, and now find the forward curve that will match my observed quotes. And we secretly know why that works, because you can replicate LIBOR payments by thinking of a floating rate bond and hold that against a fixed rate bond, and there's a nice, clean, simple arbitrage story going on. But it isn't really, it is not usually the story we tell when we do the curve stripping, and I think that's much of the same thing going on here. So, just wrapping this up, I mean, I think this pretty much says what I just told you in a little more briefly, but we got these nice forward and backward equations, and what is this, since I have 2 minutes to go, there is sort of an amusing story here, because this problem had been bouncing around our desk for a few weeks over the course of last summer, and I'd been working on it, Peter had been working on it, and should have mentioned more prominently in the beginning that this is all joint work with Peter Carr, who, aside from being from Toronto and so on, is also my boss, so it's important to mention it. But so we didn't really know that we were working on it, but we sort of were. Anyway, Peter went off to the Bachelier meetings in Tokyo and had some business trips in Hong Kong, So he had some airplane time to think, and I had some peace and quiet on the desk to think. And when he came back, we sort of said, you know, I've solved the problem. And he said, well, I've solved the problem. So you got a second-order linear ODE? Yeah. Took them out and looked, and they looked nothing like each other. And it turned out, naturally, he had solved the forward problem, I had solved the backward problem, and once we matched up the notation, they were perfect adjoints, and we sort of had a paper. I haven't quite come across that thing before, but anyway. So I think what we have here is we have a pretty good justification for kind of current curve stripping practices, from which naturally follows things like how do you price off-market swaps, from which follows how do you price index swaps, and that's. That's at least 30 some trillion dollars worth of stuff right there. So I think we've added something to this. But it also, of course, in order to do this, I think the important piece is that we needed to assume deterministic interest rates, and we needed to assume deterministic loss given default. We can do this with stochastic interest rates as long as they're uncorrelated with the default mechanism. Beyond that, I think you really need to trade something else that this doesn't span the market anymore. So you need either more complex products to trade statically, or you need to do something dynamic, in which case the analysis will get a whole lot richer. That's a good word. I think that's it.